Good afternoon, everyone. This is the internal affairs agenda today, and it is Thursday, June 9th, and I'm excited about our first speaker today. We have the City of Tallahassee here, and the Honorable Nancy Miller, who's our very own commissioner for here in Tallahassee, is here with us, and she's prepared some materials for us. And Commissioner Miller, I am so grateful to have you here today.
Thank you.
And you've got a nice presentation. The City of Tallahassee is doing a lot of wonderful initiatives on the utility front. So we're looking forward to hearing you guys. And I know you have some gentlemen here with you.
Thank you. Tremendous thanks for letting us come and share our philosophy of managing our utility. And I brought with me Reese Stode, who is our assistant city manager for utilities. And this is Rob McGarrah, who is the general manager of the electric utility. So these guys are more than capable of giving you any information that you desire. Simply put, we have a philosophy of planning and then forecasting and then investing in our customers. That's the driving philosophy behind the utility, along with maintenance and being very proactive with maintenance. We're interested in making sure that we partner with our customers, who are our owners, the people of Tallahassee, and involve them as much as possible in making those decisions about their energy future. So I think those are the primary motivational forces that bring us to the point where we're able to come. That with some very innovative thinking on the part of the management, and I'm going to go into some of that as I talk to you. There we go. Look at that. I actually did it. All right, the City of Tallahassee's electric utility is the 26th largest public utility in the United States. And in 2012, it was named the top public power operation in the country by the American Public Power Association. We're all very proud of this. This includes generation, transmission, and distribution. We serve 117,000 customers over 221 square miles. Our electricity flows through a transportation network of 200 miles with 3,000 miles of distribution, and 60% of that is underground.
Commissioner Miller, if I could stop you just,
yes.
Again, this is very informal for us. I was surprised by the 60% number. That seems pretty high. For example, Florida Power and Light has about 30% underground, roughly, and one of the the largest utility IOU in the state. Do you know how that has come to pass?
I would my guess, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, would be that when a development comes in, like Killarn, for example, comes in, and Southwood, when they come in for development, they're asked to underground all the utilities. So
that's basically it. We haven't done a new residential subdivision since the middle 80s above ground. It's been the developers that wanted to go underground. We've helped facilitate that. So that's how all of our new development for the last 30 years has been underground.
Is it a requirement?
No, our standard offerings, like everyone else, it's overhead, but there's a small fee for going underground. Now, within the city limits, we waive that. So there's an incentive for the developers at the front end to go ahead and have us put it in underground, and it's good for us to have it in underground.
Especially in a storm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Commissioner Egger has a question. Yes. Follow-up question.
Thank you. So, and I realize you said that, well, let me start over. So if a new development is coming in within the city limits and the developer elects then to underground, for the additional cost that would be a part of that, is that paid for by the developer or the residents that will be in that area, or is that difference basically subsidized by the entire body of ratepayers?
It's by the entire body of ratepayers, as long as the development's over a certain size.
Okay, thank you.
I think that it's a very competitive environment to develop property, and now there's basically a standard out there, and people want they want to live in a neighborhood where the utilities are undergrounded. And so I mean, that's a big demand. We probably get more demand for that. Everybody wants every line underground because it just looks so much better. And so I think that's a big part of it, why the developers are anxious to do it. The city operates 3 generating stations with 12 generating units capable of producing 746 megawatts during the summer season. The backbone of this system consists of 2 state-of-the-art combined cycle units, the Purdom Unit 8, which was built in 2000, and Hopkins Unit 2, which was repowered in 2008. And Hopkins has been recognized by Power Magazine as one of the top natural gas power plants in the world. This is obviously one of the cleanest fleets because 90% of the system is powered by natural gas, which has a lower carbon footprint. About 30 years ago, the city began to implement programs that encourage customers to conserve but also to assist customers. And as one of the few municipalities in Florida that generates, produces, and basically furnishes electricity, it gives us the flexibility and independence to try new programs. And so over the years, all sorts of programs, as you can see from the icons, have developed. And while the city's not subject to the requirements of the Florida Energy Efficiency Conservation Act, and therefore not required by you, wonderful people, to meet annual conservation goals.
We don't get that very often.
Maybe a first.
The city commission, well, you certainly deserve it for the work you do. Let me just say that. The city commission is convinced that a robust demand-side management program just makes sense. And that certainly reflects the views of our people. In 2008, as the recession deepened, the City Commission became even more committed to conservation in order to avoid or postpone having to build a new power plant and find new capacity. The concepts center around engaging the customer. I guess that's one of my main themes here today that you're going to hear. Our utility touches the citizens at every opportunity, and they literally sit around and try to think of other ways to get involved with the customers. Free residential and commercial energy audits, energy efficiency appliance rebates, those are available all the time. We also have a double appliance rebate program that's offered, it's only been offered 3 times, but with the huge results. Low interest energy loans, ceiling insulation grants, 6,000 of those per year. Neighborhood Reach program, which I'll talk about a little more in a few minutes. A nights and weekends pricing program that is very clear and easy and simple to understand. And then I mentioned the double appliance rebates. That was offered in 2010, 2013, and 2014. In your packet, and I brought Reese to bring a list of with a little more detail. In your packet, though, is your white paper is a complete list of all the programs and also a list of other customer-oriented programs that the utility offers.
What's been the utilization for customers with the nights and weekends program? Is it real popular? Is it still kind of new?
We have several thousand customers that have subscribed. I'm a customer. It tends to work well for folks that are away during the day and kind of meets their lifestyles and makes it more top of mind. I find that the customers that are signed up love it. Oftentimes they tell me that they're saving far more money than they could possibly save, and so that makes me feel good because that means they like it, right? So it's not just a financial transaction of can I save $5 a month or $10 a month by changing my habits. It's something I want to do, and it helps me make it top of mind. So we've had a lot of good success. It is really easy to understand, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., just no seasons, no complexity to the program.
By far, out of these programs, there are 3 that stand out in their popularity. The first one is Neighborhood Reach. The second one is the Double Rebate Program. And the third one is the Revolving Energy Efficiency Loan Program that we have. And that's been in effect since the mid-'80s. Neighborhood Reach, which was featured as part of our All-American Cities presentation last year, I believe went a long way to helping us to obtain that recognition, which we're very excited about. This program was launched in 2010 as a way to help families address utility costs. And keep in mind the perspective that 2010 was really at the very deepest part of the recession, and people really were having trouble making ends meet. The REACH team engages customers in their homes, going door to door, offering hands-on and in-home learning while they install energy efficiency weatherization measures. The team accommodates customers with free energy assessments, energy and water saving measures, performing services like weather stripping doors, caulking windows, cleaning refrigerator coils, replacing HVAC filters, and replacing light bulbs with CFLs. And I've told these guys that they're going to have to switch over to LEDs now, but whatever. And it's been incredibly effective and well-received, all at no cost to the customer.
Now, was REACH originally focused on low-income neighborhoods?
Yeah, that's what I was just getting ready to explain. Originally, it was offered to low-income neighborhoods, but, well, let's go back one sentence. This program, because this is a really important point, the program is very different in the fact that normally with these types of programs, the customer has to approach the utility, the provider. And in this case, the provider is actually going to the customers and offering the program to them. Originally, this was offered, we started with low-income neighborhoods because the neighborhood we chose, Bond, the Bond community, is a place where older housing stock, people with not the resources to upgrade their homes, to keep them in good repair, and so it was the perfect place to start. And as a matter of fact, folks were spending, in the Bond community, were spending on average, well, I'm going to go, I'm jumping ahead, but we have evaluated this, and they were spending, before REACH was there, 8 to 15% more than the average household on energy than the average household citywide. And after the REACH program came into the neighborhood, that winter they were basically spending about 7% less on energy than the citywide average. This translates into about $18 to $25 a month to folks where that is a significant piece of cash. So we were very, very happy to see that result. Once the neighborhood is selected, the REACH team goes into the neighborhood, and then they begin to go door to door to see all the folks. There's an ombudsman who comes with the team, leads the team, and he basically knocks on the door, introduces them, and explains what's about to happen. Prior to that, though, we go to the neighborhood, to a public place, a couple weeks ahead of time with the truck, with the guys in their uniforms, the very people that are going to be in the neighborhood. And it's an opportunity for them to meet, for the neighbors to come and meet the folks that they're going to be seeing on the street. They're going to see that truck parked. They're going to know why it's there. And then they also have the opportunity to answer questions of anybody, you know, of staff, and all these guys are there, and commissioners, you know, we're all there just to make them feel comfortable that this is a safe program, and they can trust these people that they're coming in representing the city and that they're going to be trying to do something to help. Nearby, other city crews are out busily at work, spiffing up the neighborhoods. They repair sidewalks. They replace broken streetlights. They clean up litter. They just do all sorts of things to show that we care about the neighborhood. And I think as a package, it really is heartwarming to see the reception that the people get, that you really do care. You are coming in here and you're trying to help. Recently, our fire department got a grant to pay for supplying smoke detectors and fire extinguishers to homes, and so that's been added to the program.
Great.
Since its inception, the REACH program has served over 7,400 homes, and resulting in 6,300 megawatt hours in annual savings for the participating residents, and this includes renters and homeowners. The program also serves as a connection to other conservation programs, which I think is critical. The folks are in the building. They are able to see, well, you know, we have the insulation program, and we have programs to help you repair duct leaks, water heater leaks. And so they're able to also inform folks on the other programs that they can qualify for.
Commissioner Brzee has a quick
comment.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just want to commend the city on this program.
Thank you.
My team and with Cindy's help, we've been out on a few of these. And so it's really remarkable to see how the community responds as the individuals, as people go from door to door. And it's interesting to watch as they go through in the house, identifying everything within the house, that there could be upgrades or things that could be done to address some of the challenges. So I want to commend the city for taking such a grassroots approach to enhancing people's lives this way.
You know, this came on about the same time I was elected, and so they've been really in part of the development. And it was such a great idea. I mean, I have not had to experience life without Neighborhood Reach. And it's such a positive relation building experience on top of the fact that you really are helping people save money. And I think this, and then the added services that go on in the neighborhood at the time, I mean, I think that really shows people that no matter where you live in the city, north, south, east, or west, your government really does care about you, because we do care about, because this your own utility thing, we all take very seriously with that. And so I think it's great to be able to actually touch people one-on-one to be sure they are aware of that, and make real differences in people's lives. The second thing I want to talk about is the double rebate program. This is offered, first of all, in 2010 for a limited time from May 26th to September 30th. That was over the summer, and the intent was to encourage people to replace older, less efficient appliances and thereby reduce their energy use. This incentive was tremendously successful, and it was brought back by popular demand in 2013 and 2014. In 2013 for a couple of months, in 2014 for several weeks. And I wanted to talk a little more about the 2014 experience, because this is the kind of opportunity that management looks for. And this is how. The state established a sales tax holiday from September 19th to the legislature, from September 19th to September 21st, and for sales tax holiday on Energy Star and WaterSense products purchased over that weekend. And to leverage this, the popularity of the sales tax holiday, and also to promote conservation, our staff came to us, came to the commission and said, look, we think it would be a great idea to put this in place for 2 weeks, for the 15th to the 30th. And so, sure enough, we did. We put it right away back into place. It'd be great to offer it all the time, but, you know, my next fact is the reason why we can't offer it all the time. In all three time periods, while the double rebates were in effect, the city experienced a surge in rebate demand.
Shocking.
Yes. And even more importantly, this surge lasts over after the rebate period is after that time period is over. So it really does reach the intended goal of focusing on conservation and giving people an incentive to, you know, to upgrade their equipment. So overall, the double rebate program and the traditional E-plus rebate program have resulted in more than $150 million in local spending since 2008. Now, that is over the time period of the recession. And because people bring in their receipts, our guys know exactly where the money's being spent. They can tell you how much money's spent at Sears or Mays Monroe or every, and they know because people get the rebates through their receipts. So we know this is being used locally, and that it residents save money, economic stimulus, local shopping. I mean, people are not going to necessarily go on Amazon to get their new refrigerator and or HVAC unit, and so the fact that the money is spent locally is just a real plus in my mind. Our energy efficient loan program. This is one of the long term programs that we have, and one of the most popular. The program is offered as a revolving loan fund. Money's always going out, money's always coming in, designed to encourage the purchase of high-efficiency appliances and heating and cooling systems. The payments are billed on the recipient's monthly bill, and this is This is only one of two loan programs in the state of Florida, and by far and away the most extensive. The program has been expanded to include Energy Star reflective roofs, rooftop photovoltaic systems, and windows. And approximately 500 people per year take advantage of the program.
If I could just stop you right there, I'm curious about the rooftop solar loan program and what the reaction has been, customer reaction. Is how many has it grown?
Well, I can speak probably more globally in terms of the rooftop solar program. Some of our customers take advantage of it, not all. It certainly eliminates some barriers to entry with the great capital cost it would take. Our solar rooftop program over the last several years has grown at 6 to 7%. We have about 250 installations in and around Tallahassee. That's not limited to residential. That's all the rooftop type solar installations, and some of them have taken advantage of the loan, but that doesn't seem to be a key factor, I wouldn't say. It helps for those that it would otherwise be a barrier to entry. It's a very generous loan program, so it's a relatively low cost of cap or low interest rate, and we do it on the bill. So it's there. I wouldn't say it's the only piece of that program that encourages rooftop solar. We've got net metering and other things that facilitate that transaction.
But that's obviously a nice, attractive incentive. Does that also include... You're only one of two utilities for solar two loan programs?
It's my understanding the other utility that offers the loans does not include the rooftop solar.
Okay. So you could be the only one.
We may be. That's my understanding. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Well, what a beautiful segue. We are soon expecting to break ground on a 20-megawatt solar farm covering 100 acres of the Tallahassee International Airport. The plant is expected to be online in early 2017 and produce more than 40 million kilowatt hours per year. While technically this program is a supply-side resource, the city is developing a customer program that will follow the concept of community solar. If people choose to buy a percentage of their power in solar, say 25%, on my bill, I would see where my normal fuel charges. I would see 25% of that would be substituted in place of the fuel charge that is adjusted every 6 months. And but as opposed to that adjustment, that adjusting fuel number, the solar number will stay the same, the length of the contract because of the contract. And so this isn't approved yet. It is not in place yet. It's just because they're still developing and the farms, you know, we haven't broken ground on it yet, but all the pieces are in place and the commission is completely supportive of this idea. So we're pretty excited about it, actually.
Commissioner Egger has a question for you.
Thank you. Community solar is something I'm sure you're aware that this commission has spent a lot of time on, and many of the utilities that we do regulate, I know, have projects that have recently been initiated or are in the works. So the mechanics of it is always fascinating to me. So for those customers who would volunteer to receive part of their generation from a solar supply, is that an additional cost that then would be on that customer?
It would supplant that portion of their energy cost recovery that's from the fossil units.
So would there be a cost change for that customer, or would their bill remain exactly the same as it would have been if they did not participate?
If the pricing we've got from the solar company, it's going to stay, it's not much different than our incremental cost today.
So are there risks to customers from this project if there is not a high subscription rate?
Oh, I don't think so. Do you?
No, if we don't fully subscribe to the project, is that the question? The rest of the generation would go into the pool as if it was any other power supply resource on our in our fleet. But
okay, I'm clear. And as you all know, my family and I are local. We live here.
Yeah,
my husband and I raise our children here. However, we are not City of Tallahassee utility customers.
Oh, but we would
I
be
know. Done. I have a number of programs. I'm very happy with our supplier, by the way. They do a great job.
Good.
Very reliable service. However, we do not have as many franchise management type programs available to us because we are serviced by a co-op. So just so you know. But yet how this works is still of great interest to me. So if I were a City of Tallahassee residential customer, and if my family chose at when it became available to subscribe, say, 25% from the solar facility, our bill would not change?
Well,
if we did not?
We're still working through some of the details. Sure. The first year solar cost is not much different than our current avoided cost or energy recovery cost. On a levelized basis, it's slightly less than 5 cents a kilowatt hour. So if you were to subscribe for it for 20 years and levelize the cost, and we're still working through those pricing options, that would be a levelized fixed cost for that portion of your energy charge.
Right.
For the life of the contract. So those are some of the details we're still working out, but clearly over the life cycle, it's because the cost is more certain, it's going to be a better deal if you're interested in subscribing to that.
And think of it this way. Right now, it's our gas prices are low, and it's pretty much on par with the gas price. Fuel price, that gas price will fluctuate over time.
The topic of the day.
I'm not sure how much lower it's actually going to get, but it probably will go up. And if that were the case, then you would be at an advantage because now you have a portion of your bill which is fixed cost, whereas you're not totally subjected to that fluctuation.
So for the permitting, construction, operation, implementation, is the risk on the city and or the customers, or is that on the developer?
The developer. We're doing this as a since we don't have access to the investment tax credit as a tax-exempt entity, we're doing this as a purchase power agreement with a third party, a company called Orgis. So they're taking all of the construction development cost and operational risk during the term of the contract, and it's a 20-year purchase power agreement with 2 5-year renewal terms.
So how did you get that deal?
We went out and did a competitive process. We issued an RFP and asked for vendors to give us proposals to construct a project like this. We actually got, I want to say it was 9 or 10 different vendors with 16 or 17 different proposals. Most of the vendors gave us multiple proposals of different options of doing it. We went through an evaluation process that looked at the life cycle cost and came up with Orgis getting the contract.
Thank you. Again, I think it's very interesting. I think it's wonderful that the commission and all of you are taking the initiative to really look at.
Well, I was excited that they were able to negotiate this price because, like I said, with gas prices where they are, to find something that's competitive with gas is because we really, the amount of time and effort that is spent on everybody's part to try to make sure that these rates are affordable for people, because we're incredibly sensitive to the fact that many people struggle with their power bill, well, their utility bill, and so... And just to finish up, in Tallahassee, our folks are engaged, and they demand conservation, and they demand solar options. Programs like REACH and double rebates and the energy efficiency loans have been accepted, have been very enthusiastically accepted, and they have resulted in energy conservation, in local spending, and in happy customers over the large part. Let's face it, power costs money. And our particular market, the folks are very, they have very strong feelings about being able to control their own power destiny, so to speak, and control how much they spend on power. So coupled with the proactive maintenance and efforts to do everything possible to maintain reasonable, affordable, reliable rates, the residents are receiving, I believe, to be one of the most outstanding services in the country, and fortunately others have recognized that also.
And very reliable.
Yes, it is. I mean, yes, the power does go out occasionally, but I mean, I don't know. I grew up when the power would go out routinely for 2 hours at a time. I mean, shoot.
You're not biased, are you?
No, but I really, you know, we are a city that loves our trees, and trees have squirrels.
Yep.
Often we have fried squirrels, and too often.
Oh, goodness.
And storms, even when the wind blows, and even sometimes when it doesn't, branches fall on wires. And so other than having 100% number, but even that's the distribution line. I mean, you know, then we've got the
transmission,
big delivery transmission lines that, you know, aren't underground, all that.
Yeah.
So. And then, you know, undergrounding, get a big flood, which we don't normally, fortunately, get, thanks to our excellent stormwater department.
Unlike Tampa.
I think that they do a great job, and I'd like to take this opportunity to publicly commend these gentlemen, because
Absolutely.
Both of them have been working really hard for a long time to make this story one that we can bring to you today. So thank you very much, and if you have any other questions, we'd be delighted to answer.
We're all very interested in what the city of Tallahassee does. Commissioner Graham has a follow-up.
Well, you guys are fortunate you're not part of our DSM program. Actually, I think all municipals should not be part of our program. I think it allows for you guys to be freer on the things that you do. I mean, you're not tied to 2-year paybacks on rebates and all that sort of stuff. You can kind of do whatever works best for your community. I mean, you can give away the free fluorescent lights or LEDs, and you can see the immediate impact, those sort of things, when you do that kind of program. Do you guys also handle the water and wastewater for City of Tallahassee? I mean, I'm guessing, but normally that's probably got to be the largest user of power for the City of Tallahassee.
We do provide the water and wastewater. We operate that utility. We've got about 85,000 customers of water, a little less in wastewater. The city as a whole is one of the larger users of electricity. That's normally the way we would track it. But the water utility in particular would not on its own rise to that level. It's a large power user, but we've got large customers like our institutional customers like that. They would tend to be far, far larger.
It's just it gives you some of that freedom. You know, if you guys decide you want to switch out those pumps for higher energy conservation pumps,
right.
I mean, you're allowed to do that sort of thing, and it's kind of win-win for everybody.
Yes, sir. Sorry,
we're going to take that quote public, right?
Win-win.
But I mean, it grants you guys a lot more flexibility, especially when you're controlling all access. And I'm assuming that everything goes out in one bill, water, wastewater,
right.
Electricity, and so I mean, it's a wonderful world sometimes when it works like that. I applaud, and you know, it's interesting. One of our fellow commissioners, Mayor Martins, used to brag about your utility all the time. I mean, when I first got here, you know, he's one of the ones that kind of reached out to kind of welcome you to Tallahassee and welcome you to the commission, and he talked, you know, very, very highly about the utility. I think I've heard a lot, and I think you guys are doing a fantastic job.
Thank you.
Because I think the mayor was on the Public Service Commission made him especially focused on energy, and it gave him the opportunity to hear from utilities all over the state. So thank you for saying that, and I'll pass that along to him. I want to give a little bit of, well, I want to not leave here today without giving credit to our customers. They demand these things. And they pay attention, and they get involved. They come in, and they make their wishes known. We get emails about ways we can conserve, and we pursue any suggestion that anybody has. But as the capital, with a lot of state folks here, I think that people are there. They're also exposed to practices all over the state and even probably the country. And then these guys are part of national organizations. But I would say that our customers and the pressure that they put on and the demands that, you know, they want to be involved. And so they're part of the picture for sure.
And Commissioner Miller, I was just going to follow up with you on that, because you started the conversation talking about the customer, and the customer is really the owner here. Mm-hmm. And I think that is unique for a utility, at least in our world here.
Yeah.
So I think that's
an interesting perspective to start with. I'm curious because there's so much buy-in on the customer side in the city of Tallahassee with the demand-side management programs. You have, you know, just a lot of unique and innovative forward-thinking programs and initiatives. How do you reach out to your customers? How is that dialogue achieved and to keep it so positive?
Well, for one thing, we have a utilities marketing department, and their job is to, we use WCOT, we talk about these things at the commission meetings regularly, and then that all evolved into, there's the audit program, which that's a pretty well-recognized program, but I agree that it's critical to be able to get the word out, because a lot of times the people that are most in need of the programs are the last people to hear about it. But we have a utilities marketing department that is focused on how to do that. And they have booths at public events all mm-hmm. the time. We have, you probably know.
There's a newsletter in every state.
Yes, that's right. And we also, as you all know who spend very much time in Tallahassee, we have an event a minute. Just go to Cascades Park. And they have booths there all the time.
There is definitely a lot of buy-in.
Not just Cascades Park, but everywhere they can. Anytime there's a public meeting, we'll be having a budget workshop, for example, that's out in public, and they will have a booth, you know, right there all about all of this information. So they really go above and beyond trying to make sure that they reach the people that need to hear about the programs.
That's great.
And most of this is offered to commercial as well as residential. So, you know, everybody's got the opportunity to participate.
Well, you're doing a great job. You all are very forward thinkers, and we're happy to have you. And thank you for taking the time share some of the highlights of the city of Tallahassee. Commissioners, are there any further questions? Comments?
Thank you very much.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for having us.
It's been really nice
to come and visit with y'all.
Thank you.
Come back again.
Well, we will.
Open door. Thank you, guys. All right. Moving along with our agenda.
Your work.
We are moving along. We're getting to the legislative implementation. It's very limited to House Bill 491. Hi, Casey.
Good morning.
Good morning. Afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yes, Commissioners, as promised at the last Internal Affairs, this item is staff's proposed implementation plan for three statutory revisions in HB 491 that we believe will require rulemaking by the Commission. Three topic areas really to be addressed. The first one addresses rate case expense for staff-assisted rate cases. The legislative change prohibits the award of rate case expense during a SARC to recover fees incurred by a utility for work performed by attorneys or outside consultants prior to staff's initial report. And of course, unless OPC or another party intervenes, in that case, rate case expense can be awarded. This particular section of the legislation is we are required to propose a rule by December 31st of this year. Staff anticipates that only minor revisions will be necessary to comply with the statutory amendments, and so we don't anticipate any problems meeting that deadline. The second topic area is pass-through expenses. The legislation amends Section 367.081 to include additional expenses for which a utility may automatically increase or decrease approved rates given 45 days notice. The legislation also gives the Commission discretion to establish by rule additional pass-through expenses, but any expenses that we would add would have to be done through rulemaking, but we would have to review them every 5 years to make sure they should stay eligible for pass-through expense. We propose revising Rule 25-30.425 to reflect the additional expenses eligible as set forth in legislation. Staff will also review expense categories to see if we can identify anything that we would recommend adding to the list that the legislature put forward. Staff believes rulemaking to comply with this aspect of legislation can be accomplished expeditiously, and so we propose that it follow the same track as that of the rate case expense. The third subject area regarding utility reserve funds. The legislation adds a subsection to Section 367.081, which enables the commission on its own motion or upon utility request to authorize the utility to create a reserve fund for repair and replacement of existing distribution and collection infrastructure that is nearing the end of its useful life or detrimental to water quality or reliability of service. The legislation directs the commission to adopt rules to govern implementation, management, and use of the fund. And the rules shall include, at a minimum, expenses for which the fund may be used, segregation of reserve account funds, requirements for capital improvement plans, and requirements for commission authorization of disbursement from the fund. So this is going to be a much more complex rulemaking exercise. And so this would be on a separate track. Now, even though the legislature doesn't set forth a deadline for us to accomplish this, separate statutory requirements would require us to propose a rule by April 1st of next year. We're available to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much. Commissioners, do you have any questions on this? Looking forward to seeing how that utility reserve fund pans out. Do you have a time frame? I know you said April.
We would have to.
It's your birthday?
No. We'd have a proposed rule by April 1st, and so what that contemplates is staff will begin work on a draft rule that we would then put out there for comment by stakeholders. More than likely, we're going to be having a rule development workshop or two on this particular rule. And then once we go through that process, staff will revise the draft, given the input from stakeholders, and bring a proposed rule to you.
Great.
At which point, that would need to take place by April 1st.
Looking forward to it. All right. Moving on to the Clean Plan Power Plan update. We've seen lots of emails from Catherine over the past month or two.
Yes, this update is since our last update on April IA. In the Clean Power Plan litigation, which is on the existing plants, on April 15th, the petitioners filed their reply briefs. They filed on procedural issues and on legal issues. The petitioners filing these briefs include the state of Florida, Gulf Power Company, CO2 Task Force of the Florida Electric Power Coordinating Group, and Seminole Electric Cooperative. The final briefs of all parties were filed April 20th through 22nd, and on April 28th, the parties filed their proposals to the court regarding the structure and length of oral argument, which at that time was scheduled to be June 2nd. But on May 16th, the D.C. District Court of Appeals, on its own motion, ordered that oral argument be rescheduled from June 2nd to September 27th. The court also ruled that instead of being a three-judge panel, it would be heard en banc, that is, by the entire court, instead of by the three-judge panel. The entire court is 11 judges. Two of the judges did not participate in that order. You know, if that happens at oral argument, then it would be a nine-judge panel. You know, don't know yet. Regarding the new, modified, and reconstructed source rule, the next action in the court case is that we've got briefs due for petitioners July 15th, 2016. Respondent EPA's brief is due September 23rd. Petitioners' reply briefs are due October 21st, and then final briefs are due at the beginning of November in 2016. No oral argument date has been set. And another, however, on May 24th, petitioners and the petitioner interveners filed a motion asking the court to suspend this briefing schedule. And the reason for this is they had filed petitions directly with EPA asking for reconsideration of that particular rule, and EPA denied reconsideration. So the petitioners state to the D.C. court that they are planning to file asking the court to review EPA's denial of their reconsideration of the rule. The deadline for that is July 5th, so at this time that briefing schedule remains. The court hasn't ruled on the motion yet. EPA and other respondents are opposing that motion.
Thank you for the update. And before we get to the other commissioners, I'll turn to Commissioner Edgar and ask if you'd like to add anything. Or...
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just briefly, and thank you for that update. This makes me think kind of the metaphor of the duck for the Clean Power Plan, which, it, you know, with the stay in place, it may appear that not much is really happening and it's just moving, but if you look just under the surface, there's a whole lot of activity that is still going on all of these issues for many states and also nationally. And also to point out that on the surface, it may seem that from moving for the existing plans or existing sources, moving the date from June to September may seem to be a delay, but in actuality it probably is not, because it does move past some of those additional processes that could have taken place if indeed there were oral argument before a panel and then there was a request to take it en banc eventually. So the point being, our staff is on top of it, which I know we're all very appreciative of, but these issues continue to move forward.
Thank you, Commissioner Egger, and thanks for tracking and continuing to be engaged on it, on the national front and on the state front. Commissioners, any other questions or comments? Thank you again. Thanks for keeping us apprised. All righty. We are moving along to General Counsel.
Yes, I'm Madam Chair, and you're very busy.
You are busy. We all are busy. All right. Executive Director's report.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Siruk and the Brise birthday bash. June 12th through 15th. We have the Regulatory Attorneys Conference again coming on the 19th through the 23rd. As advertised, upcoming service hearings, June 16th, Melbourne and Daytona Beach, June 27th, Miami, June 28th, Fort Lauderdale and Pembroke Pines, June 29th, Miami Gardens, and Commissioners, the staff has been preparing to hold a series of workshops beginning in July that's going to target Class C water and wastewater utilities. And the purpose of the workshops is to educate and raise awareness of the Commission's procedures and regulatory processes and the requirements of those processes. They're going to be held at various locations around the state, and it's to facilitate the small water companies' participation in our processes, the goal being, you know, to get them to learn how to file their annual reports properly and to learn when to come in for their rate cases on time and to also participate in the various pass-throughs and indexes and all the to be able to facilitate an orderly participation in those processes.
Commissioner Graham has a question for you.
Are these workshops going to be live stream? If they're not live stream, are they at least going to be available online for
That's a good question.
Those people that can't actually make the workshop but are interested in the things that happen during the workshop?
The long view, because that's a good question, Commissioner, the long view of it is to have those workshops set down into a type of webinar that's going to be accessible on our website. But the real value of the workshops is to get the actual utility owners and operators in live, because that creates one-on-one contact with our staff personnel to actually walk them through the. Remember, these are real small mom and pop utilities, and it creates the one-on-one human contact to actually have a staffer walk them through the filling out of the forms and the annual reports and so forth. The added value to all of this is we're coordinating with the Florida Rural Water Association. FRWA has a program where they're trying to. They have a program where they provide these small water utilities with computers. I don't know whether you know this or not. I'm sure you've heard the stories. A lot of these small utilities, they don't even have computers in order to access, for instance, a webinar. Mm-hmm. you know, much less to file an annual report online like we want them to do, because this is sort of what we're moving towards, trying to move towards as an agency. So we're trying to coordinate all of these things, and so we're very thankful and very fortunate to have the Rural Water Association to work with us on that. So if we, so the real value is to get it live. And we're hoping to do this, you know, again, this is pie in the sky. We're hoping to do this every couple of years to be able to establish that kind of, and in the end get all, have contact with all the small water companies and make this a normal thing, so that you know, they can actually get the knowledge firsthand.
So the short answer is yes?
Yes, very long answer. Yes, we are. There's a larger strategy, but yes, we are. Initial locations, Pasco, Polk, and Marion County, with additional locations to be announced. And we'll keep you apprised of the progress.
Commissioners, any other questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that with us. Moving on to other matters, just two recognitions. If I could get Laura King and Lynn Deemer to just come up here for... I stole Laura King's little Employee of the Month award from her. She got the benefit of having it over the past this past month in May. And just to tell you a little bit about her, she has been with the agency for 23 years, starting in telecom, and just recently transferred in 2014 to the Division of Engineering, and quickly rose up to the manager position, and really a dedicated manager. The whole agency really supports all the work you've done in those various capacities, and since we didn't have an opportunity in May to formally give this to you, I want to thank you and congratulate you for everything that you do for us. Thank you. And moving on to this month, and Lynn and I haven't had an opportunity to get together and get to know each other a little bit more, but she's been with the commission, and you started out in the Tampa office back in 1986.
Mm-hmm, that's correct.
Been with us for a lot. Moved to Tallahassee in 1991 as a computer audit analyst, and now she is the chief of auditing since December 2012. Fun fact about her, and I can't wait to get to know her a little bit more, but she rides Harley-Davidson.
Oh, yeah. Go Harley.
And we're grateful to have you here at the commission all these years, and thank you so much for the service, and hope you're enjoying your spotlight this month.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Are there any other matters? Anyone? All right. Thank you. This meeting's adjourned.
Good job. There we go.